union members by paying a membership fee. So in drafting the constitution that governed the operation of the union, it was declared from the beginning that the union was a membership organization for students, faculty, alumni, and staff of the university, plus patron members who were interested enough to become contributors by way of membership. And this in turn led to the nature of the governing board that was described in the Constitution, namely a policy board called the Union Council, which included representatives of these three constituent member groups, students, faculty, and alumni. And with a student majority, 9 out of 15, and with a student as chairman. This to emphasize and make dominant from the beginning the concept of the union as a self-governing enterprise at the university that recognized the prime participation of students in governance, and in turn, as this all, of course, had a bearing upon our historical objective and the union historical objective of encouraging the development of student leadership of their own affairs. So, from the beginning, the Constitution described the kind of institution this was supposed to be, not just another administrative department of the university, but a self-governing organism in which the joint decisions of students, faculty, and alumni were to determine policy in operation, subject only to the final review of the regents.
Who drew up this constitution?
It was initiated primarily by the student president of the men's union board and myself. Together we made the preliminary draft based upon student objectives and what I knew of successful union practice, and submitted this draft to a general committee on, it was called the University Committee on the Union, which was a planning committee headed by Dr. Harold Bradley.
This is a general faculty committee?
It was a general faculty, administrative, staff, alumni, and student joint committee of some 40 members, as I remember. And in turn, they adopted this draft. It went through, of course, various modifications, but it went from there to the faculty. The faculty approved it, went to the regents, and the regents approved it. This became our charter of operation. And its purpose, the purpose of the union, is set forth in one simple sentence, namely, the union is created to provide a common life and a cultivated social program for its members. And again, you see the emphasis on membership, which has been one of our strengths and one of our protections over the years, the fact that we are a membership organization. The self-governing feature of it has also been one of the very difficult and complex objectives to work out within the tight state of Wisconsin controls over all university operations, to set up within a tight state control situation enterprise with wide latitude for self-governance has been something to manage to bring about over the years. And sometimes we've had setbacks on it, and sometimes we've had successes. But that's another story too.
Why do you say that being a membership organization was a protection?
Well, that perhaps leads on to one of the kinds of things that started to happen once the building got open. First, let me say that the Constitution was devised and approved. The financing of the furniture and equipment was achieved. And the management staff was achieved for the opening in 1928. And I should say a word about the managing staff. I was asked to become director of the union by both the Memorial Union Building Committee and by this committee headed by Dr. Bradley, which planned for the union. Theirs was a recommendation to the university administration. I think it's fair to say that everybody was a little nervous about this. Here was a young fellow, 25 years old, with no management or business experience to speak of, now placed in charge as director of a very considerable physical plant and program and financial operation. And the university hedged this, and with my to my relief and concurrence, by drawing in the Department of Dormitories and Commons in the person of Don Halverson, who was director of Dormitories and Commons, to be the business operator. Halverson was the business manager of the union at the beginning. I was the director. Halverson had run the Lathrop Hall Food Service. He was, of course, head of the newly built residence halls and the dining operation there. Very successful administrator. And so I was relieved that I didn't have to worry about the price of potatoes and what price to charge for a given meal and how to train the janitors and so on and so on. And my time was freed largely to work with students and to develop the social cultural program of the union. But Halverson, in his generosity and wisdom, made it clear that he wanted to take policy direction for his business operations from me and the union council or union governing board. And this is the way it worked and succeeded. Well, that was the staffing approach. Now, back to your question of why was the membership emphasis important and protective. Once the building opened in 1928, it showed up with considerable success in a lot of directions, in services to the university, to students, in interesting things to do, and very prominent in the press whatever we did. And with this successful note in front of everybody, a lot of other parties wanted to get into the act. They weren't so eager to be in the act when we had problems and were trying to raise money. But once a going concern gets going and is useful and influential, others begin to want to get on the bandwagon. One of the first things that happened was that the Alumni Association figured this was very risky to leave the operation of this now successful big enterprise in the hands of a governing board that had a majority of students on it, with a student president and a young fellow, 25 years old, as director. So they made a pitch with the university administration to transfer the governance of the union to an all-alumni board of governors, or mostly alumni. And at this point, two things happened. The Memorial Union Building Committee, the other influential group of alumni, including a number of past alumni presidents, and the people who'd come forward and raised the money, and who agreed with the student primacy in the building, persuaded the Alumni Association to drop this idea. And part of the argument was that, look, this is not an alumni enterprise. All students are members. This is where the membership implication comes in. All students are members. Not all alumni are members by any means. Only those who chose to become life members are members. Also, there are many faculty who are members. Not all. It was voluntary, but faculty as with alumni. So it just isn't right to have a policy and governing board that is dominated by alumni when the membership of the organization is much more than alumni. Well, then came lawsuits from merchants on State Street in the hotels downtown against the union under the Unfair Trade Practices Act because they felt that being a tax-free institution and serving meals and providing hotel rooms and so on went far beyond the legitimate role of university teaching and was unfair to them as food service people and hotels who did have to pay taxes. And so they initiated a court suit to prevent us from serving food and accepting hotel reservations and so on. But we were able to show that we did this only for our members, that it was not, that these services were not open to the public. And we could cite our whole membership policy, the fact that we made line checks at the cafeteria and elsewhere to determine whether the person entering had a student fee card, or which was his membership card, or if an alumnus or faculty member, whether they had a union membership card, and so on. And so we were in very large measure protected by our membership approach against the charges that we were serving the public and doing so unfairly to the enterprises that had to pay taxes. They didn't believe us. They felt we didn't take the membership thing seriously. But actually we did. And,
but it worked.
And in the end, the suit was thrown out. On the other hand, we had the reverse of this. We had the taxpayer who thought the building was paid for by his taxes and other taxes, which it wasn't. It was paid for, as you've seen, by a gift.
This is illustrated by the case of a taxpayer, a chap who was really something of a troublemaker in the building, instituting a suit against us, against me personally, and against the union organization for asking him to leave the building and not admitting him in the future. This suit happened to be taken to court on the same day I was called to court to defend the union against commercial restaurants and hotel people who were charging that we did admit the public freely. Well, as I mentioned, the restaurant suit was thrown out and the taxpayer suit was not pursued after the Attorney General's office, which represented all departments of the university, made the point that we were indeed limited by our own policies and by the university's policies to serving those who were members of the union and not the public generally. All of this didn't entirely satisfy the restaurant hotel people, because they found a legislator, actually a former student at the university, who prepared on their behalf a resolution in the legislature creating a legislative investigating committee to investigate the whole operation of the union and whether or not we were unfairly competing, and along the way making charges that we were running it inefficiently and expensively, and that the whole operation really ought to be turned over to students to run, and that a paid staff full-time was really not all that necessary. This investigating committee went to work, had a series of hearings, and we were asked, of course, by the university administration, President Glenn Frank, to present the documentation of who we were and how we came to be, what we were doing, and what our financial operations were like, and the results of them, and quoting the various regent authorizations to do what we were doing, and so on. And in the end, that legislative committee turned in a report in effect exonerating the union of any malpractice or bad behavior. And I think one of the things that influenced the legislative committee was the prestige and influence of the Memorial Union Building Committee members, who were widely known throughout the state and who had voluntarily set forth to raise the funds to build this building, to do these certain kinds of things, including offering a food service to students. And the legislators on that committee, in their perception of the situation, in effect said that if this is the kind of institution that was given to the university and to the state by reputable leaders in the civic life of the state, it must be all right, and they didn't want to discourage gift efforts of this kind by denying the functions and purposes that the founders had in mind. So after a long ordeal and much distraction from our daily requirements of doing our job, we were in effect cleared by the legislative committee, and in turn their report to the legislature satisfied the legislature. So that, at least for the time, ended that kind of interference with the union operation. But I was mentioning earlier that because the union now was up and going and apparently a thriving institution and a success and influential in all sorts of university affairs, others up and down the line wanted to get into the act too, including sharing in the glory, let's say, or sharing in the control and direction which the union would take. So over the years, and I'm talking now about a span of years from the early 1930s up to the present time, mm-hmm. we have had off and on desires by the Dean of Students' Office to have more to say about the union, and in fact, at one point, wanted the administration to place the union under the administrative direction of the Dean of Students' Office. And then the business manager of the university, who had reason to be concerned about our financial outcome, he wanted to have more say about the policy.
Could you tell me which dean of students and which business manager these were?
Well, I think if my memory serves me, as long as Dean Goodnight was dean of men, and who had himself helped raise the funds for the union, knew what it was for, and felt, as he often said to me, personally, I'm so happy there is a union and a union governing board and a student leadership of it, because that relieves me of a lot of problems and burdens that would ordinarily have landed on my desk. So through Dean Goodnight's era, which was a long one, there was not this kind of interference or desire to take over, although, as I guess I mentioned earlier, being a strict moralist and disciplinarian, he often wanted to assert his standards in what the union did, illustrated by the fact that during the war, for example, when we were serving thousands of servicemen in training on campus, and whose day of leave was on Sunday only, our governing board and our student leaders arranged social affairs for servicemen, including mixer dances on Sunday. This was contrary to the actual existing university regulations, which Dean Goodnight was the administrator of, which said quite plainly, no social events, no dances certainly, on Sunday. So he let it be known that we couldn't do this, that it was against
his policy and indeed against the written social regulations, which, by the way, he wrote.
Oh.
There was no so-called General Student Life and Interest Committee at that time, which represented the faculty generally and embraced student representatives and so on.
So there were two or three men
and women, the dean of men, the dean of women, and I remember the head of journalism and the head of the speech department, or drama department. They were the ones, but Dean Goodnight really called the shots, and they did whatever he thought was necessary to do.
So what did the union
The union governing board set up, as I've described, as being the governing board, policy-making board for the union, responsible to the president of the university, not to the dean of students, but to the president, and through him to the regents, appealed to the president, who was President Dykstra at that time, against this ruling. And we had a joint conference in President Dykstra's office, and when, after he heard the details of the story, he looked up and said, "Well, I guess the war's being fought on Sunday as well as every other day." And that's when the men in training for the war can come to see you. "I think you better go ahead and serve them, just as they're serving the country on Sunday." So the union appeal won out. It was then some years after Dean Goodnight's end of service that there came into the picture other deans, and ultimately reorganization of the whole dean of men's and dean of women's set of offices under so-called dean of student affairs, a generalized dean. And this was in the era of rapid university growth. We're talking about the post-war period, of course.
Post-war.
And the president, then E.B. Fred, much plagued by all sorts of new and difficult problems, thought, as somebody had recommended to him, and I don't know who it was, that it might be better to have us report through the, what was then called the Vice President of Student Affairs, Kenneth Little. Well, Kenneth Little, this was set up on paper as the route through which the staff reported. But Ken Little was understanding and said, "Go ahead and do what you've always been doing, which has been fine." And so there was this, there was a considerable period of benign neglect on the part of the administration so far as any initiative by the vice president of student affairs is concerned. It was only later, when the Harrington regime came in and Martha Peterson was made dean of student affairs, or vice president of student affairs, I don't just recall the title, for the entire university system, that the problem arose again. And she, through the agency of the vice president, Clodius, set forth to have the union made responsible quite clearly to the dean of student affairs on the Madison campus and so on. And we were so notified without much prior consultation. Well, at this point, the union trustees, the same Memorial Union Building Committee group that raised the funds for the building and which cherished the whole idea of dominant student policy making and governance of the union through a representative board of students, faculty, and alumni, questioned this and questioned it very strongly in meetings with Clodius and later with Harrington. And at first, and citing, among other things, the constitution or charter of the union, which was approved by students, by the total faculty, by the regents, which spelled out that the union was responsible to the Board of Regents through the president of the university, or chancellor as he was then called. The response from Clodius was, well, that's a piece of paper, we can change that. Well, this didn't sit well at all with the founders of the union, who invested their time and money and effort in creating a kind of union that would be a self-governing institution and train students for civic leadership. And there were further consultations and delays, and in the end, this was not really put into effective effect, this kind of change. It was, there was a kind of a compromise that said that the Dean of Student Affairs would be welcome as a non-voting member on the Union Council, the governing board, for liaison and communication and coordination purposes, and as would be also the business manager of the university, because he had a vital interest in this too, and he was not about to let the financial destiny of the union rest in the hands of what the Dean of Student Affairs had to say about it.
Which business manager?
Because he was responsible, and ultimately, for the financial well-being of the union.
Who was this?
We invited the business manager of the university to sit on the
government. Which business manager was this?
Pardon?
Which business manager was
this? Well, at this time, it was Neil Cafferty. Oh. And we're talking about the 1960s, recall it now. And Cafferty never came. He wasn't so minded. The dean did occasionally come, not often. But the Dean of Student Affairs also had a director of student activities on his staff. And there was a complex of problems arising as to the demarking line between what he had to do in terms of counseling and supervision of student activities and what the union, which was one of the main student activity, had to do. And so there were times at which the student activity advisor thought that he ought to have something to say about the whether the union was properly engaged in this function or whether it should be turned over to student government or one of the other groups that he was advising. So there was a good deal of back and forth to straighten out these staff organizational and supervisory questions along the way. Well, what we're citing here are the continuing desires of other parties to have a piece of the action, and we've mentioned the Dean of Students and the business manager. There was also student government, the newly formed Wisconsin Student Association, who felt that they ought to have more to say about it. Actually, the Union Constitution provided that their four officers sit on the Union Council.
Could they vote?
Union Governing Board. This was from the very beginning.
Could they vote? Were they voting
members? Oh, yes, they were voting members. And this was the principle involved, that of the nine students, the majority on the Union Council or Governing Board, five would be students who came up through the merit system, who had worked for a year, 2 years or more on union committees, and were deeply involved firsthand in what the union was doing because they were leaders of the enterprises and of the programs, and therefore could bring to bear direct personal knowledge of what the union's objectives, the union's problems, and the union's ways of accomplishing something were when they considered policies. But to make way for the voice of the people to be registered, and not just those who come up the ladder through the union civil service or service program, the four officers of student government were also included as voting members who were elected by students each spring or fall. And so we thought we had a blend of voice of the people as represented by student government people and experience firsthand knowledge of what the problems were, represented by the five students who had chaired committees or been very active in actual union operations. And all this student energy and enterprise and set of goals reviewed with, and in some cases tempered by, the presence of two faculty members appointed by the president of the university, two alumni, one appointed by the president, one by the alumni association, and then the director of the union and the business manager of the union sat on the same union council ex officio. They were in the minority. So a student majority could settle an issue. It was rare, however, or ever, that when there was a split vote, that a split between students and non-students. It was split in many other ways.
That's interesting.
Some faculty or one alumnus voting with students, some students voting with the opposition, or with the staff if it was a staff recommendation, and so on. This was the original pattern of union governance, and which still exists, by the way. There have been some name changes and minor adjustments due to the change of university merger and so on, to get the right titles in, chancellor instead of president, and so on. But in principle, it's the same kind of organization.
Is it the same size?
And interestingly, when merger legislation came, merging the University of Madison with all the other state higher educational institutions, There was this provision, you may recall, in this new merger law that fees paid by students for non-classroom instruction, namely for athletic purposes, publications, health service, and union, that students should have a primary voice in how these fee funds were to be expended. Well, the union right away qualified, because 40 or more years before the merger legislation, we'd set up the union policy board this way: primary voice of students, with a student chairman of the board. And this position was adopted by the regents and the university administration in their response to the legislature and to anyone else who wanted to know if the union conformed to the intent of the merger legislation. Well, besides the groups mentioned that wanted to get into the act, there were the various university departments that had an interest in the union: the drama or speech department, music school, and art department, and so on, where they could see that we were engaged in somewhat like activities. In art, for example, we were presenting art exhibitions, and art education, as it was called then, or applied arts earlier, was interested in that. And in the case of the music school, we were bringing outside artists for concerts, and they were interested in that. Journalism had continued to assign many student reporters to the union to report on the goings-on at the union. And home ec saw in the union kitchens a laboratory for helping to expose their students to bulk food service operations and menu making and so on. These relationships all worked out really very well.
They did.
They were on the whole very harmonious. The other departments were glad to have these laboratory or field work opportunities available to their students.
Could you tell me how you arranged that? What kind of operation was set up so these departments could work with the union?
Well, we would simply consult with each other, as with home economics, for example, as it was called then, consult on when and how often they would like their students in food preparation and institutional management to come to the union for a laboratory exercise, observation, explanation by the union staff, and in effect, we taking over a series of laboratory sessions for them. And in the case of art education, it was not hard to come by. I had been a student of Professor Varnum's, who was chairman of the art education department at that time. One of my courses related to my art history graduate major was a practicum in etching and graphic arts generally and so on. And they had no gallery or museum outlet. We did. and we were glad to arrange for exhibitions by their faculty members, for exhibitions by their graduate students who were doing artworks as part of their requirements for a master's degree, for example, Master of Fine Arts. And then we had organized early in 1930, a general student art competitive exhibition, which was open, of course, to all students, but particularly art education students found it an outlet for letting the public see what they were doing. And by this time, years after the union opened, we'd gained quite a little experience in art museum administration. There was no course in art museum administration at that time. And art education was glad to establish one, but they had no one on their staff ready and willing to take it on. So the union staff, our art director and myself, became the co-lecturers and instructors of a new course in museum administration, using the Union Gallery as a laboratory, so on. And then, in the case of drama and speech, the Union Theater housed their whole theater production organization, stage shops, costume shop, rehearsal rooms, all the equipment for lighting and production, and of course the auditorium, the theater itself, for their audiences. They were supremely happy to get out of Bascom Hall, second floor lecture room with the tablet arms that rattled when people sat down. A genuine fire hazard, a stage that was tiny, no side stages, no storage space, no rehearsal room. So the speech department, through Andrew Weaver, the director of the department, chairman of the department at that time in the 30s, was a most enthusiastic and helpful person in urging and helping us to obtain the new theater plant, theater wing of the union.
So when the Union Theater was finished and opened, the whole drama operation, including staff, moved into the Union Theater. And the technical director, Fred Berkey, and the drama director, Russell Lane, went on split appointments. Part of their appointment in speech and part of their appointment at the union. So we were dividing salaries.
So you were paying them part, the union was paying part of their salary.
Yes, and properly so, because besides their Wisconsin Players or speech department drama productions, they were also serving the other groups that came into the Union Theater.
Such as?
The Harefoot Club, Humorology, the variety show that was put on annually, the French plays, French department plays, the conferences and conventions, the university ceremonial occasions like baccalaureate and honors convocation, and of course the traveling performing arts groups, which the union had already been heavily involved in. Concert artists, traveling stage shows, ballet, symphony, and so on. They were the union managing staff for all these non-speech department functions that occurred in the theater.
I see.
So we found a formula for how much of their time went to speech department teaching and play production, and how much represented service to the union. Well, this was also easy to come by because, as you've heard me say, we tended to understand each other. I'd grown up in the theater. I was a member of National Collegiate Players, the honorary drama group. And in the case of art education, I was an art history graduate student and knew what art was about. And so there was no problem of personal rapport, but this also extended into the rest of my my staff. The art director of the union, the first one, was Sally Owen Marshall, who was a graduate in art education. And the next one, Ann Kendall Foote, a graduate in art education and well respected and known to the faculty of art education. So we didn't have these kinds of interdepartmental squabbles or problems. At least not until it came time to build the Communications Arts Building, but that's in recent years, but that's another story which I'll save for another time, and when we discuss physical facilities and expansion and so on. Well, I guess I've said enough about the growing interest of parties throughout the university, downtown, at the Capitol, including the auditors, in this new phenomenon called a union that suddenly burst upon the scene. So I think now it might be worth turning back to what we were trying to do. What was it all for, if that's satisfactory to you?
No.
Is it?
Yes, I think that's a very good idea.
As you perhaps detected in your readings about the union, we came into this whole enterprise pretty innocent of what a union was about, except as we've heard the Van Hise inaugural address, except as we knew what the Men's Union Board had been up to in terms of kinds of functions and activities, and except as we learned more about the unions through John Dollard's exploration of unions in helping advise the faculty committee on student social needs to what these needs were.
He had studied some of the earliest unions, had he not?
This was part of his role as secretary of that committee, was to visit particularly the Michigan Union and Harthouse at Toronto, which were the largest and most evident unions and newest in the early 20s. So being not sure just what this was all about, I guess We felt it was important to find out all we could about it. And so I, with others on my staff, reached out for anything that might bear upon the union function and purpose. There's not much to be learned from the National Association of College Unions. It was not well organized. It had a modest, ineffectual newsletter that mainly told about new buildings being planned and so forth. Nowhere was there much said about overall purpose or identification of the union in the scheme of things at a university. We could see that it had a good deal to do with off-hour recreation, and the facilities of themselves denoted this, ballroom and game rooms and browsing room and music listening room and so on, so on. So we gathered together all we could of hopefully useful information, and of course watched what we did ourselves and what students wanted and how they responded. And this, I'm talking now about the period when I first came in as a full-time staff member in 1926 on fundraising, and then in 1928 as director.
Now I have a question. How did you find out what students wanted?
Well, this was not at all hard to come by, because basic to the whole scheme of union organization was the creation of student committees to do the programming in the building. A committee in each area of student interest, such as social, including dancing, music, because we had already been engaged in presenting concerts, and art, because we now had a gallery and an opportunity to undertake an art program. Discussion and debate, because this was, we found, a historic purpose of the earliest British unions. They were debating societies originally, and Harthouse was very strong in discussion and debate, and our own Wisconsin student debating societies by this time had expired. There was hardly any evidence of them in the mainstream of student life anymore, and they were concerned mostly with judges giving points on whether their rebuttal was adequate and whether they had an effective voice and won an effective audience response and so on, a kind of a technological thing rather than battling out current issues of importance to students and others. So a so-called forum committee was part of it. Then we had a commons committee. The whole dining enterprise was called commons. Cafeteria, trip commons, what was first called a tea room, then the Georgian Grill, private dining rooms and so on. We had a student committee to explore what the potentials of these rooms were, often through surveys of customers on what they liked and didn't like about a given service or room, and advice on what we had better do about some complaints that came in. So we had altogether 200 or 300 student committee members who were telling us week by week what they wanted to do and what their fellow students were telling them. Then besides the feedback from our student committee members, we had suggestion boxes around the building, inviting people to slip pieces of paper in, and we had the pad of suggestion forms next to the box, telling us what they would like to see happen or what their problems were, what their complaints were. And I made a point of seeing every one of these, and either I answered them or got the appropriate staff member to write up the answer, and we would post the complaint or the suggestion, and then underneath the union's response as to what the answer was or what the next move was going to be, and so on. So this was one of many typical things that we tried to do to remain sensitive to the wishes of our constituency.
Do you still do this?
Pardon?
Do you still do this?
Well, it hadn't happened this way or this much in recent years. We still have the committee system, mm-hmm. but we don't have the suggestion boxes. Although I'm sure the staff tries to learn wherever it can what our customers and clientele want, and their occasional surveys made, often by a class in social statistics, for example. Not done by the union, but by as a class exercise training to them, but useful information for the union on student attitudes toward the union, what they use and how often, and what their feelings about it are. There have been several of these in recent years, as well as back all through many years. Well, to show you where we were after our first 2 years, I resurrected, pulled out the pamphlet we got out at the end of the year 1929-30. Entitled The Four Objectives to the Union. And I thought I might just refer to these briefly, these four objectives, as indicating where we were at